Welcome, folks, to the Hour of the Tongue, the only hour that ever was or ever will be. This is the most important hour in your entire life, for during this hour, you will decide your future and thus our collective futures. I am your host, William Cooper.
What's good, y'all? In one of my recent videos titled Why Conspiracy Theorists Have a Bad Rep, I dived into the perception of conspiracy theories, exploring their history and more, which you should definitely check out, by the way.
Do it!
However, I wrapped up by mentioning some OG truth seekers who have had a significant impact on those who chose to explore conspiracies as a whole over the last 20 to 30 years. One of those men goes by the name Bill Cooper. In today's video, we'll explore the life and legacy of a man who made a profound impact on our world. He predicted one of the most world-altering events and authored one of the most influential books in the realm of conspiracy. Additionally, he hosted his own radio show. However, his story concludes with a tragic and gruesome standoff with the police, ultimately leading to his untimely demise. Join me as I unravel how this all went down and what we could all learn from this man's pursuit for truth and freedom. Milton William Cooper, better known as Bill Cooper, was born on May 6, 1943, in Long Beach, California, at the Bixby Knowles Maternity Hospital, which would end up getting sold in the late 1950s. Bill came from a strict military background, born to his father, a United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, Milton V. Cooper, and his mother, Dovey Nell Cooper. Bill describes his mother as an extremely tough and resilient woman that came from a broken home, while his father was a strict militant man that would often frustrate Bill at a young age, only to realize as he got older why his father acted the way he did. Bill, like many Americans, was a full-blown supporter of the quote-unquote system, if you will. In an interview, he'd even stated that he was quite the indoctrinated individual.
I was reared in a military family. My father's an Air Force colonel. He's retired now. He was a command pilot. And I traveled all over the world, lived on military bases for most of my life. I was really an indoctrinated individual, you might say. I was as establishment as you could get, as gung-ho, pro-government, pro-America, pro-military, and that's why I went into the military.
His life, for the most part, was pretty normal growing up with two siblings that were fraternal twins by the name of Ronnie and Connie. Like most siblings, there's always bickering, but they usually all got along well. Since his father was a military man, Bill found himself living in many different places growing up. By the late 1950s, early 60s, Bill attended high school in Japan at Yamato High School. He graduated in 1961 and enlisted in the Air Force, following the footsteps of his father. He initially wanted to join the Navy, but his tendency towards car sickness and seasickness got in his way. Bill attended basic at Lackland Air Force Base and technical school for aircraft and missile neutronics at Amarillo Air Force Base in Texas. Bill explained how, in a short time after entering the U.S. Air Force, he went from a skinny kid who didn't know much about anything to an airman who had a secret security clearance and worked on B-52 bombers, K-135 refueling aircraft, and Minuteman missiles. Then fast forward to November 22, 1963, Bill was on duty as a charge of quarters for the field maintenance squadron. While alone, he decided to turn on the TV, and what he'd end up witnessing left him in utter shock. The United States President John F. Kennedy had his brains blown out right before his very eyes. Being the militant man he was, this hit him really hard. In 1965, just 2 years later, Bill left the Air Force with honorable discharge. In December of that same year, he finally decided to join the Navy. He'd always loved the ocean and wanted to be a sailor as a young kid, and he was finally ready to overcome his fears. Bill was sent to Naval Training Center in San Diego for boot camp. His prior experience in the Air Force helped him land the role of a recruit chief company commander, allowing him to keep his rank and pay grade. Bill mentions that he had a great team around him at the time and was able to learn quite a bit. After he'd completed his training, he was sent to Hawaii, specifically the site of Pearl Harbor, where he was tasked to work on the USS Tyro submarine. However, during his time as the port lookout, Bill would go on to witness something that would change his way of thinking forever. Upon raising his binoculars at the right time, he witnessed a huge disc rise from beneath the ocean, with water streaming from the air around it, tumble lazily on its axis, and disappear into the clouds. He was literally speechless as he was convinced he just witnessed a flying saucer, the size of an aircraft carrier, come right up out of the ocean and fly into the clouds. Disgruntled and shaken up, Bill was torn. He wasn't sure if he should share what he'd seen or keep it to himself, knowing that others might have a hard time believing him. He ultimately made the decision to inform the officer on deck about what he had witnessed, prompting an investigation into the area he had mentioned. This stirred considerable commotion, prompting the captain's intervention and summoning Bill and his crew members to the commander's room for questioning regarding their observations. When Bill's turn came around, he spoke honestly, stating that he believed it was a flying saucer that he saw, which, strangely enough, led to tension from the commander. However, the commander quickly shifted his approach, attempting to defuse the tension by asking Bill once more what he had seen. This time, Bill provided the response the commander sought, stating that he had witnessed nothing. The commander then commended him, remarking him that with such an attitude, Bill would excel as a sailor, essentially suggesting that his dishonesty has spared him. Bill realized the severity of the consequences he could have faced for speaking up, including hefty fines upwards to $10,000 or imprisonment. Relieved to evade trouble, he agreed and signed a document, agreeing to maintain silence about his observations. Following this harrowing experience, Bill's faith in the establishment began to erode. He eagerly sought to free himself from submarine duty, feeling a sense of relief after leaving the environment behind. Bill then got transferred to the USS Tom Bigbee, which was a gasoline tanker where, according to Bill, the crew and captain were a combination of idiots and misfits, leading to some pretty rough situations. He would end up on two Westpac tours aboard the Tom Bigbee, which included 12 months off the coast of Vietnam. After that year, Bill was transferred to Naval Security and Intelligence School for Internal Security Specialist. This training was meant to prepare him for securing perimeters and safeguarding classified information. In 1968, Bill had graduated and made the decision to fight for his country in Vietnam. And although he spent a brief period on the coast, he truly wasn't prepared for what he was getting into. After landing in Da Nang, Bill made his way to Camp Carter, where he met with the captain and was positioned as the patrol boat captain. With a lot of pressure on him, he knew he really had to give it his all. As Bill describes, he and the crew had many spooky nights and run-ins with good old Mother Nature. One instance, he described a rocket which hit the ammo dump at the river's edge near the Da Nang Bridge, stating it looked as if the world was coming to an end. Unfortunately, during this time, Bill would go on to lose a friend and fellow soldier, making this even more personal for him. Despite the loss and hardship, he would end his time in Vietnam with a few medals and ribbons to commend his efforts and was on his way back home. Ending up back in Hawaii around 1970, Bill found himself in charge of shore duty at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet at Makalapa, a hill above Pearl Harbor. This role granted him security clearance in the Air Force, but it didn't stop there as it took just 6 months for Bill's security clearance to be upgraded. It was shortly after this moment when Bill's life would truly change forever. Bill attended a team briefing where it revealed that the JFK was an inside job carried out by the limo driver. This moment became the catalyst for Bill's subsequent research, leading him to go AWOL in pursuit of answers, driven by his complete loss of trust in the establishment. 2 years after his time in the military, Bill ended up getting married on June 2nd of 1972 to his wife, Annie Cooper, and they would go on to have a daughter by the name of Dorothy and another later on by the name of Allison. Bill later attended Long Beach City College, where he picked up an associate science degree in photography, He then founded the Absolute Image Studio and Gallery of Fine Art Photography in Long Beach, California. But despite adjusting to family life, Bill knew deep down that he had to get the word out about what he'd discovered, and let's just say he'd be in for one hell of a journey. Following Bill's departure from the Navy after going AWOL, he found himself deeply questioning the very nature of his service, particularly in light of the dismissive handling of his observation of what he believed to be a flying saucer, alongside his insights into the circumstances surrounding JFK's. Fueled by a burning urge to share this newfound knowledge, he embarked on a mission to enlighten others. Around this time, Bill was going public with his information, which seemed to stir up trouble. He describes being run off the road not once but twice by a black limousine with two men who confronted him about his public disclosures. However, during the second incident, they not only caused him to get his left leg amputated but also visited him in the hospital, making a final attempt to have him stop what he was doing. Of course, with Bill's determined nature, he simply went along with what they wanted to hear, and just 24 hours later, he managed to get the word out to as many people as possible by mailing envelopes filled with information to some people he knew, some congressmen, and even some random people from a mailing list he obtained. Keep in mind, this was before the internet era, so for an ordinary person to disseminate information to a large audience overnight was much more challenging than just clicking an upload button on a social media post. During that period, Bill believed that if he could reach as many people as possible in a short span of time, any potential harm to him would only serve to validate his message. And let me tell you, he was dead serious about it, as he'd end up shelling out $27,000 of his own money to make it happen. The money Bill spent went toward printing copies of his own document titled The Secret Government: The Origin, Identity, and Purpose of MJ-12. At this time, Bill was heavily focused on the topic of extraterrestrials, UFOs, and government cover-ups. In this document, he touches on the 1947 Roswell, New Mexico crash and how President Truman and his administration were well aware of extraterrestrial life and did their best to keep it under wraps, along with other things. At this stage in Bill's life, around the age of 47, 48 years old, he'd released a fair amount of documents and videos, but little did he know the impact that his next piece of work would end up having. In 1991, Bill finally managed to summarize his life experiences and research into a 500-page book titled Behold a Pale Horse, published by Light Technology, a small New Age-oriented house then located in Sedona, Arizona. Just from the table of contents, you could see the book covers a wide array of topics, and it managed to become one of the top-selling underground conspiracy books, selling over 300,000 copies and reaching a very wide audience all over the world. It likely would have sold even more if it weren't getting stolen off the shelves so much at one point, but at the same time, it was a testament to its impact on the readers. His book would even go on to have great influence in the realm of hip-hop, with artists like Prodigy of Mobb Deep and ODB of Wu-Tang, amongst many others, making reference to either Bill's name or book in their lyrics. Now, rather than me explaining the meaning behind the title, I'll let Bill do it himself.
This title is from the book of Revelations, because I have to tell you this, and you may think I'm nuts if you want to, but this is the truth. Either these men are following the book of Revelation, the book of Revelation as it is in the Bible. Mm-hmm. They're either following it, just like a plan, and bringing the prophecies in there to pass to manipulate and control those who believe in those prophecies and neutralize them, so to speak. In other words, if this is written in the Bible and God has ordained it, who am I to resist? It must come to pass, so I'm not gonna try to stop it.
Okay.
What a perfect way to neutralize the opposition right off the bat. Or there really is a God, and what he said was going to come to pass is coming to pass. And I named this Behold a Pale Horse from chapter 13 of the book of Revelations. The fourth horse, the fourth horseman of the apocalypse, is the pale horse. And I looked, and behold a pale horse, and his name that sat upon him was death. And hell followed with him, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword, and with hunger, and with the beasts of the earth.
Now, aside from the impactful release of Bill's book, his continued research then led him to delve deeper into what we now all know as Area 51. However, in the early 90s, the United States military never publicly acknowledged its existence. Undeterred, Bill was determined to learn more. He drove all the way down to southern Nevada with the goal of documenting what he saw, even bringing others along the journey. Together, they filmed the outskirts, attempting to capture any odd aircraft activity when possible. As a result, Bill managed to complete two documentaries titled Project Red Light 1 and 2. But not too long after the release of these two documentaries in 91 and 92, Bill had slowly started to shift his perspective on UFOs and extraterrestrial life. This perspective leaned more toward the notion that it was likely the United States military themselves behind UFOs, and that he himself might have even unintentionally misled others into the notion of extraterrestrials being behind it.
In all the history of the world, folks, if we were really being visited by extraterrestrial life, don't you think we would have found one by now? Don't you think so? And how come the government always gets there first? It's podunk time. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's a farmer milking his cow, a flying saucer crashes, and the government gets there before he can get from his cow to the crash site. It's ridiculous, and I shudder to think that in the beginning, when I first came public, I may have been misleading somebody along those lines that this whole thing is being brought about by extraterrestrials. I think some of us were really used in the service of our country, and I'm very angry about that.
Bill also grew frustrated knowing that he was being grouped together with other speakers in the UFO community who were knowingly spreading misinformation. In an effort to distance himself from this, he shifted his focus to explore the significance of political trickery, government schemes, and less on the paranormal side of things. Around this time in 1992, Bill had been living in the quiet town of Eager, Arizona, a little isolated from the others in the community on his hilltop home with his wife and daughters. It was during this period where he'd not only start up his legendary radio show titled The Hour of the Time, running from 92 to 01, but he also founded the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence, which essentially served as a unified group of independent researchers seeking out information on a wide array of topics from secrecy within government, politics, finance, entertainment, the occult, Freemasonry, mythology, ancient mystery, religions, the esoteric, the exoteric, I mean the list goes on. Bill would eventually meet a fellow researcher by the name of Doyle Shamley at a conference Doyle was organizing, and the two quickly became good friends, and Doyle would soon move out to Arizona to work alongside Bill in pursuit of their research efforts. Doyle was also one of the co-hosts of the radio show, along with Robert Houghton, another close friend of Bill at the time, who we'll briefly talk about later. As the popularity of his show soared, it became evident that Bill's outspoken nature was increasingly endangering his life. He began to face harassment from government agents outside his hilltop home who were determined to prevent him from broadcasting. It became apparent that they were willing to resort to any means necessary to silence him. As Bill's popularity grew, so did the frustrations of those attempting to silence his voice. The Hour of the Time addressed a mix of both historical and contemporary pressing events, including the 1993 Waco siege, the 1995 Oklahoma City the assassination of JFK, the connections between secret societies and governments, and much more. Despite facing criticism from many who disagreed with his point of view, Bill never let it hinder him. He continued to push forward, knowing he had a mission to disseminate this knowledge to as many people as possible. Unfortunately, as the years passed, Bill's journey for truth would become even more challenging. In 1997, Bill had been interviewed by the Lakeside resident agent due to his allegations pertaining to Tim McVeigh and the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995. From 1998 onwards, Bill encountered escalating pressures from federal agents pursuing various charges against him, with tax evasion being the primary accusation. This is evident in an FBI document on Bill or William Cooper, where he is characterized as a right-wing patriot, widely recognized in the militia movement for his contentious broadcast via shortwave radio. It states that on June 19th of 98, a U.S. deputy marshal attempted to serve a criminal summons on Cooper, but Cooper refused to accept the summons and he ordered the deputy off his land. The summons was issued as a result of an IRS tax evasion case against Cooper for which he has been indicted. It is extremely unlikely that Cooper will show up in federal district court in Phoenix as required on July 1st. Indeed, Cooper seems to be relishing the role he has created for himself in defying the IRS and federal government. He has written a long explanation entitled, Cooper Family Targeted by Feds, which has been released on the internet. A quick side note, in 1995, Bill was convinced that President Bill Clinton and the IRS were targeting him for exposing the fraudulent nature of the organization. Then after the Oklahoma City bombing, Rush Limbaugh read a White House memo on the air during his podcast, which named William Cooper, quote, the most dangerous radio host in America. Mr. Cooper considers William Clinton's pronouncement the greatest compliment that he has ever received. The document further elaborates on their concern that Bill would be unyielding and difficult to apprehend, suggesting that capturing him wouldn't be straightforward. It even goes as far as to classify him as armed and dangerous. Bill openly discussed his predicament on his radio show, reinforcing to his listeners that he was in serious trouble. However, according to Bill and his close friend Doyle, the tax evasion claims were far from the truth, and from what they could see, Bill was clear on his bills and had no outstanding balances with any sort of companies whatsoever. And about a year after the federal agents breathing down their necks in an attempt to get them tied up in legal troubles, things slowly began to die down as the agent initially tasked with the job had been transferred off the case. But of course, this peace and quiet did not last long, as Bill would notice even more agents this time, tasked to keep a close eye on him, and it was getting to the point where Bill knew he had to get his wife and children out of that hilltop home as the pressures from the agents increased. From 98 to 01, Bill's broadcast began to get even more controversial, garnering more attention. Plus, it probably helped that some of Bill's earlier predictions were beginning to come to light. One example of this being his claim that, quote, the sharp increase of prescriptions of psychoactive drugs like Prozac and Ritalin to younger and younger children will inevitably lead to a rash of horrific school sh-. These incidents, he said, quote, will be used by elements of the federal government as an excuse to infringe upon citizenry's Second Amendment rights. Talking points like this really started to hit home after the 1999 Columbine massacre. But that prediction surprisingly pales in comparison to one of his later predictions in 2001, just less than 4 months before his unfortunate death. On the 28th of June 2001, Bill was yet again hosting another episode of Hours of the Time, but that particular day, he made a prediction so accurate that truly had people in shock when it eventually panned out. Bill went on to explain how the U.S. needed a new boogeyman to bring about the One World Order, and that boogeyman would be none other than Osama bin Laden. He very clearly states in the episode that there was likely to be some sort of major attack that would occur, and when it did, it would ultimately be blamed on Osama bin Laden.
And now we're being bombarded with messages that Osama bin Laden is planning to attack the United States of America. And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major, but it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order.
Now, while that prediction was brewing, Bill would end up in some hot waters with law enforcement when he'd have a run-in with a man by the name of Dr. Scott Hamlin, a fellow resident of Eager, Arizona, where Bill stayed. One particular day, Dr. Hamlin decided to take his wife and kids to a spot where he often went as a kid himself to get a view of the town when the storms would approach. This spot so happened to be on Bill's property. Dr. Hamlin had never met Bill before, but knew the reputation of the man who lived in the house on the hill. Dr. Hamlin went on to explain how Bill's car rolled up and told Dr. Hamlin that it'd be in his best interest to drive away. According to Dr. Hamlin, he gathered his family into the car and attempted to head home, but He stated that he was followed by Bill all the way back to his house, where the two got into an argument, leading to Bill pointing a gun at Dr. Hamlin's head, telling him to never step foot on his property again. Dr. Hamlin then called eager cops, but claimed they were reluctant to take action. So he contacted a high school friend who worked at the Apache County Sheriff's Office, and their team decided to investigate. Strangely enough, on September 11, 2001, exactly 75 days after Bill had made arguably his biggest prediction to date, the United States would witness one of the most world-altering events in the past two decades, being the attacks on the World Trade Center. And just as Bill had stated, the government and the media placed the blame on Osama for the attacks.
On this day 10 years ago, Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan received word that the day of the attack had been finalized.
The very same day the attacks went down, Bill was meant to be served a warrant for his arrest, which got postponed, likely because they couldn't find any real proof that Bill was the one that pointed a gun at Dr. Hamlin or even followed him in the first place. Bill, thankfully not being served a warrant that day, was able to go live on air for over 7 hours, engaging with callers from various states, discussing the situation, and sharing insights drawn from their reports on local news. Now, the fact that Bill managed to practically lay out the script months before it played out led many to believe that it was the reason that he'd face a vicious demise just 55 days later.
For which they're ready and willing to die for at any given moment that they're called upon to do that, is already dead and are of no use or consequence to themselves or anyone else and will be unhappy throughout their life.
Given Bill's research and his outspoken demeanor, he was well acquainted with the challenges inherent in his pursuits. On several occasions, he made it abundantly clear that he was willing to die for the cause. And it so happened that in the late hours of November 5th of 2001, bleeding into the 6th of November, Bill would end up doing just that.
An Apache County Sheriff's deputy is in the hospital after being shot in the head by a so-called militia member.
Now, what we know is that that militia member is dead. Our Gary Harper has the very latest on what's going on with that story. Gary?
Marty Scott, this all happened in a little town called Eager, Arizona, which is just on the eastern side of the state of Arizona. It's almost on the border of New Mexico. This is what we know so far. Sheriff's deputies, we understand, were trying to serve some type of arrest warrant on a man by the name of William Cooper. He's also known as Bill Cooper. He reportedly has been known to be hostile toward law enforcement. So sheriff's deputies apparently disguised themselves as a bunch of rowdy teenagers in the back of a pickup truck in hopes of luring Cooper out. And it apparently worked. However, when Cooper realized what was happening, he reportedly pulled a gun and shot a 40-year-old deputy in the head. During the gunfight, Cooper himself was shot and he was killed. Now, this is what we know about Bill Cooper. Officials say he belongs to some kind of militia movement and has published several anti-establishment articles. He has a website, we understand, and on that website, he acknowledges that there is an arrest warrant for him, but he writes, and we're quoting here, any attempt by any federal government agent or anyone else to execute the unlawful arrest warrants will be met with armed resistance. Any person who attempts to kidnap our children will be shot upon discovery. And that is apparently what happened earlier this morning. Sometime after midnight, Cooper reportedly pulling a gun and shooting a 40-year-old Apache County Sheriff's deputy in the head. That sheriff's deputy, we understand, has been flown to Phoenix, where he is in a hospital. We are trying to get his condition right now. We do not know exactly what his condition is, and we understand that the militia member, in this case, Bill Cooper, was shot to death. We do have a crew en route to Eager, Arizona, and we'll have a lot more coming up on tonight's news.
There were rumors that Bill was egging the Eager Police Department on during a broadcast the day he was killed, but his close friend Doyle Shamley denied those claims. In a 2005 interview with Robert Houghton and Doyle Shamley, they discussed the murder of Bill Cooper and how it all went down, and Doyle was able to share a lot more context for those that were curious, so here's what they got into. Doyle described Monday, November 5th, 2001 as a regular day. He'd went to work, ran a few errands, and stopped by Bill's place for lunch. Doyle recalls that Bill was in a pretty good mood that day and had been working on a big project that he was excited to share with his viewers. Doyle would end up going on about his day, leaving Bill's place, but little did Doyle know what would transpire in the later hours of that day. As you've heard from the news segment, Bill was at his hilltop home in Eager when he noticed a truck full of what appeared to be rowdy teenagers drinking and listening to music on his property pretty late at night. It was a familiar scenario for Bill, as his house had a pretty good view of the town, drawing in teenagers who frequently hung out on his property, prompting him to regularly intervene. Little did Bill know, but this particular night, these rowdy teens were actually a group of officers in an unmarked vehicle and plain clothing from the Apache County Sheriff's Department, there to supposedly serve him a warrant. But mind you, it was around 11:30 p.m., approaching midnight, when they did this, and they were clearly going about it in an unconventional manner. Robert mentions how, contrary to popular belief, Bill actually had a decent rapport with local Eager Police Department. And although Bill disagreed with the structure of police in America publicly, Robert was confident that if Eager Police were to serve him a warrant at a more reasonable time, that Bill likely would have just answered the door calmly, but it seemed apparent that this wasn't the goal of those particular officers. Now, hearing the ruckus, Bill got in his truck as they were parked several yards away from his home, and he lived on that hill with no streetlights and an unpaved roadway. Rolling up on his truck, asking them to leave his property or stating that he would go back to his house to call the Eager Police. At this point, from what Doyle was told, the plain-clothed officers still did not notify Bill that they were police there to serve him a warrant, which is obviously strange considering Bill mentioned he'd call the police. But this is where things got way more intense, as Bill began to do a three-point turn back to his house where his car was ambushed by more officers, yet this time they were dressed in uniform, and Bill's window was already rolled down from talking to the guys in the truck, and an officer ran up to his window, to which Bill shoved him down. But reports tried to claim that Bill literally tried to run him over, which Doyle states wasn't true. This is when Bill knew something was seriously wrong here, and according to Doyle, he was told by a local sergeant of the Eager Police Department, who was at the scene in the morning, that Bill actually put his truck in park and stuck out both hands of his window, basically signaling that he wasn't a threat. At this conjuncture, approximately 14 officers were present on his property with an unmarked Apache County car attempting to block access to his home. Despite reports suggesting otherwise, Bill did not reach for a weapon, despite having two in his vehicle as stated by Doyle. Instead, he skillfully parallel parked in front of his yard, disembarked, and ran around the back of the truck to reach the front door. As Doyle put it, quote, "When we say run, people need to keep in mind we're talking about a previously wounded, one-legged veteran. Bill had to wear a prosthetic leg, and plus at his age, he wasn't able to move fast. So approaching his front door, he noticed the other officers coming out from hiding, and at this stage, they finally identified themselves as Apache police." According to an Eager police officer who spoke with Doyle after the fact, it was then when Bill had pulled out his .38 Smith & Wesson and started to pull the trigger, causing them to do the same. It was reported that one of Bill's shots hit an officer by the name of Robert Martinez. The details continued to remain murky about the investigation and coverage of the story, of course, and it seemed very apparent to Doyle that Bill was to not make it back into his house alive that night. After being shot several times, Bill's body was tragically left to bleed out going into the early morning of November 6th. When the paramedics came, apparently they kept their sirens off and made no attempt to resuscitate Bill, but of course, made effort for Officer Martinez. What makes this even more bizarre is that the local county coroner was Dr. Scott Hamlin, the very man that Bill supposedly had gotten into a scuffle with back in July. Obviously, due to his conflict of interest, he wasn't assigned to work on Bill's body. And for the listeners of Bill Cooper that were curious, Robert also inquired about Bill's dogs, Sugar Bear and Crusher. Sadly, Crusher met a tragic end when shot by an Apache police officer while chained up and barking. The officers claimed he nearly bit them when they approached, justifying their actions. Sugar Bear, on the other hand, managed to escape after being unleashed, but later returned and found a new home with a family friend. As for Bill's wife and daughters, it's said that they're currently living outside of the US, but there isn't much known about them, and that's probably for the best. In the days that followed, Doyle found himself handling the aftermath and aiming to secure access to Bill's extensive collection of recordings and documents. The police were convinced that Bill's home was booby-trapped, fearing a potential Waco-like scenario if they attempted to enter. However, Doyle worked diligently to confirm that a situation like that wouldn't happen. The Apache police ultimately handled the task, aka murdered Bill, transferring the paperwork to Eager Police Department despite their lack of involvement in the ordeal. Doyle even heard that since the media tried to make Bill out as some militia leader, local officers feared there would be an uprising at his home, which also wasn't the case. All of this Doyle described was on the 6th of November, and the following days after Bill's murder, he described independent writers poking around the area trying to get more info, and since Doyle was left to deal with it all, people would always notify him about what was going on at Bill's home. Doyle knew he had to keep things professional in light of how Bill was already portrayed in the media, and he did his best to do that. Doyle had been so busy dealing with everything that the whole ordeal didn't really hit him until about 4 days in after Bill's death, when he was inside of Bill's home going through paperwork, and that's when it sunk in that there wouldn't be any more lunch hangouts between the two. The funeral ceremony for Bill was held at a Presbyterian church in Springerville on the 15th of November, and as Doyle explained it, it was a challenge finding a place, as most turned them down, but one pastor felt it was only right to offer their space as he believed every man deserved a proper burial. Apparently, there were police snipers surrounding the church in case anything were to go down, and Apache County police were even questioning those attending the funeral. Of course, the police seemed eager for some major problem to occur, but that wasn't the type of timing Bill's friends were on. And as for the ending of the interview with Doyle and Robert, Robert asked Doyle about two women that were in Bill's life 20-odd years ago, to which Doyle explained they came to the funeral and caused a little bit of ruckus, claiming to sue and that they were trustees of Bill's estate. However, their cases were thrown away and nothing ended up coming from it. Till this day, many suspect that Bill was indeed taken out due to his influence growing larger and larger, especially after his 9/11 prediction. But, of course, there isn't really any way to know for certain the exact motive behind what led to his tragic death. Despite Bill's death being over 20 years ago, his legacy has lasted the test of time, considering his book Behold a Pale Horse is still being sold and his clips are still circulating throughout the web and in the realm of conspiracy. Hell, I'm talking about him now. And although his name might still get wrapped up with certain movements in the modern age that don't have the best reputation, such as QAnon, Bill was far from those types of individuals. Yet he surely did make a lot of people mad with what he shared. At the same time, he knew it came with the territory. His voice often struck a chord with his listeners, and he truly spoke with conviction every time he did. But at the same time, he was honest and open enough to tell his supporters to, quote, listen to everyone, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you could prove it in your own right. Now, as a fellow truth seeker myself looking into the life of Bill Cooper, there is a lot to admire and there are a lot of things one could learn from his pursuit to freedom. For starters, it's clear that no person can do everything on their own, and this is why Bill formed a team, albeit small, especially in his later years, to have a community of like-minded individuals with him. And this helps a lot as the journey to enlightenment can be quite lonely and isolating yourself doesn't do you any good. We also learned that communication is key. The reason Bill's message landed so many times was due to his understanding of the English language and his time spent researching. Although he wouldn't be right about everything, because let's be real, who is? He would always manage to get his point across clearly, and if he did get something wrong, he wasn't afraid to admit it. But I'd say the most important thing one could learn from Bill was to not gas yourself up as some sort of all-knowing truth guru, as it will become ever so clear to your audience that you're just a shill pushing some hidden agenda. He always stated that he was just your average guy and there was really nothing special about him, although we can certainly say he made some special contributions to the world. But ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of today's video. I want to send a RIP out to Milton William Cooper, better known as Bill Cooper. If you guys enjoyed the video, please do your boy a favor, hit the like button, drop your boy a comment, let me know what I might have missed, share the video, but most importantly, subscribe, man. Remember, all of those things are free to do. Spin your boy script, and I'm out of here. Peace. Peace. Peace.